From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I think that the first people who should read this book are our brothers and sisters in the United States, because their threat is in their own house.
That was the then president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, speaking at the United Nations General Assembly's general debate 13 years ago on September 20th, 2006. He was referring to the then president of the United States, George W. Bush.
The devil is right at home. The devil himself is right in the house. And the devil came here yesterday. Yesterday, the devil came here. Right here.
En este mismo lugar,
right here.
Huele a azufre todavía.
And it smells of sulfur still today.
The Trump administration has been very busy with Venezuela over the past year, particularly since January, when President Trump signed a decree recognizing Juan Guaido as the president of Venezuela. Guaido has yet to actualize that decree by taking control of any part of Venezuela. And maneuvering is reportedly going on behind the scenes to allow him a place at next week's General Assembly's general debate. For more on all of that, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, from Managua, Nicaragua.
The big news over the last week or so about Venezuela, there are a couple of things. One is that a few days ago, the United States government and its cronies in the Organization of American States, the governments that are accomplices to the heinous U.S. policy attacking Venezuela and its people. And they invoked something that most people thought was dead and buried, namely the Inter-American Reciprocal Assistance Treaty, or sometimes also referred to as the Rio Treaty. And I think that was 1948, 1949.
Yeah, well, you know, to be fair, most people thought the OAS was dead and buried until the last year or so. It was kind of dormant while all these other groups had been popping up in Latin America.
Right. And of course, signed the revival of the OAS is part of the attempt by United States elites and their regional allies in Latin America and the Caribbean to revive right-wing policies as a viable political option in the region. And they got off to a good start in 2015 when they managed to install a government in Argentina under the right-wing kind of there in those elections in Argentina in 2015, Mauricio Macri, who won by just 1.5 or 2% of the vote. And also they managed to get a very good result in the Venezuelan legislative elections, where the combined opposition grouping known as the MUD won 112 seats out of 167, leaving the parties that supported the government with only 55 seats in the legislature. And back then, it looked as though there was an unstoppable wave of support for right-wing policies in the region. And that's how a lot of commentators interpreted it.
Right.
And, of course, they were hopelessly wrong, because events have shown, the right-wing policies in Latin America just... They have no future. They don't work. They're based on nothing.
Well,
based
you know,
on a pack of lies.
The OAS, for example, when they reopened the OAS, when they revitalized the OAS, it was about the time that they reopened Southcom. I mean, it's like the handmaiden, you know, the diplomatic handmaiden to Southcom.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And something that many people probably don't realize, but that I've noticed year after year here in Nicaragua, is that when the ambassadors changed here in Nicaragua, the departing ambassador invariably goes to work in U.S. Southern Command in some kind of political stroke advisory role. And so, you know, the the role of the U.S. military, in particular the fiefdom in, down there in Florida, known as Southern Command, which all, sometimes even seems to have a life of its own, given the pronouncements that come out of it. But they're intimately related, of course they are, with everything that happens in the region in terms of diplomacy. And you can see that very much so in what's happened to Venezuela over the last few months. But going back to the, for the moment, to the Inter-American Reciprocal Assistance Treaty, the so-called Rio Treaty, and that what that was supposed to do back then in the late 40s, it was supposed to kind of armor plate Latin America and the Caribbean against interference from the Soviet Union, and that was what it was about. And subsequently, when indigenous communism took root, in particular the Cuban Revolution, but also later on the ascent to government, to office, if not power, of Salvador Allende in Chile, and that kind of demonstrated the kind of total irrelevance of military defense against an outside power, and that was what the Reciprocal Assistance Treaty was originally for back in the late 40s,
right.
And it's shown to be completely irrelevant by then.
Right.
And so when you look at that now, well, and various countries have withdrawn from it. All the ALBA countries withdrew from the Reciprocal Assistance Treaty many years ago. And now it's been revived by the United States and its right-wing allied governments in the region. Not so much to promote it. I don't think that it's going to be used to promote a direct military intervention in Venezuela. But some of its provisions give the associated governments that have supported the measure technically legal administrative justification for increasing sanctions, for example, against Venezuela, which at the moment they have very little cover for in terms of international law. So there's that aspect to it, but perhaps a deeper look suggests that it's a sign of the desperation of the United States that it hasn't been able to achieve its end by military means.
Right.
And they what they thought 2-3 years ago, there would be what some people might call a cakewalk to overthrow the government of Nicolas Maduro, because they believed their own rhetoric.
Right.
They believed the opposition rhetoric that Nicolas Maduro was an unpopular dictator with no popular support, and that was the line that was offered by the Venezuelan opposition. It was completely untrue, and we both know that the ruling political party in Venezuela, the PSUV, the United Socialist Party, and they under Chavez in various forms have won, what is it, 23 elections?
Yeah, something.
Since 1998.
Yeah.
And so in election after election, the Venezuelan opposition have lost.
Right.
And then when they won an election in 2015, they accepted that, and that was exactly the same electoral authority,
right,
that for 15 years prior to that,
right,
they'd been claiming was corrupt and fraudulent.
And as a matter of fact, what happened when they won that election, which was conducted by the administration of Nicolas Maduro, that government, as soon as they got elected, they were practically saying that their own election was proof of the fact that the system was flawed and that the government was illegitimate, that he was a dictator, even though they had just been elected, you know, during his quote-unquote regime.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's completely insane, isn't it? And it's always been like that.
Well,
and
here's what's crazier? What enabled this setup of the process with the OAS But the legal basis for it was back in May that Guaido, you know, the guy that John Bolton appointed as president of Venezuela, sent a request to the OAS, to the to the Secretary General Almagro, asking that Venezuela be reinstated in the regime, you know, in the treaty's regime. National Assembly, which has been, you know, abandoned by the government, you know, under the Constitution and replaced with, you know, with the Constituent Assembly, approved a return to the treaty. And so that was that request from this government, that's not a government, was the basis for the OAS to recognize the call for this invocation of this.
Illegal.
It would be like if you decided I was the president of the United States and I made a request to the OAS for the OAS countries to occupy the United States so that I could seat myself in the White House. Can you imagine me trying that?
And the whole procedure is completely illegal.
Same, too. It's like childish.
And in any case, was not applicable to the Venezuelan case. There's no point even going into the legal arguments. I mean, it's just obviously absurd.
Right.
But all this is happening in the run up to shortly the UN General Assembly will open in New York. And so the question then is, will the United States authorities allow the legitimate representatives of the Venezuelan government to enter and participate in the General Assembly proceedings? So they've been putting pressure on Gutierrez, the Portuguese General Secretary of the United Nations, to recognize Guaido, the usurper government of Guaido, as the legitimate representative, so that they can create a platform for Guaido in the UN. And so far, Gutierrez has resisted that pressure from the United States to recognize Guaido. But it's still not clear what will happen when the vice president of Venezuela's legitimate government, Delcy Rodriguez, who's been named as the representative, who will travel to New York for this year's UN General Assembly. It's not clear what the US authorities will whether they'll even allow her into the country. It's not clear at all.
Yeah.
Never mind what will happen at the UN.
Yeah.
But in response to what the United States has been doing in the OAS with its allies, President Nicolas Maduro has announced that partly as a response to what happened in the OAS with the Reciprocal Assistance Treaty, and partly in response to the decision by Juan Guaido to withdraw from dialogue talks with the legitimate Venezuelan authorities that have been facilitated by Norway, President Maduro made a surprise announcement. Well, it took a lot of people by surprise. He made the surprise announcement that they were opening up an alternative dialogue within Venezuela with moderate elements of the Venezuelan opposition.
Right, I heard that too.
There are various conditions that they've agreed, the various points of agreement that have been points of controversy between the Venezuelan government and Guaido, but which the Venezuelan government has felt able to negotiate with these other representatives of what most people regard as the more moderate opposition in Venezuela. And one might ask, well, what's the difference between the moderate opposition and the more extreme opposition? And the difference is very simple. And the moderate opposition don't want a civil war. They don't want U.S. military intervention. They don't want the population subject to economic sanctions designed to starve people and deny them access to medical care. Now, in the moderate opposition want a normal country with normal political processes, and they don't agree with the more extreme right-wing parties in Venezuela. The two most important are called Popular Will, Voluntad Popular, and Justice First, Primera Justicia. And those Guaido himself is a member of the Popular Will, Voluntad Popular Party. And those two extremist parties are the parties that have been pushing for U.S. intervention, calling for U.S. sanctions to attack Venezuela's people. And the moderate opposition are against that. So, but the interesting question then is, you know, having agreed to these conditions, I mean, one of the conditions is that the 55 deputies, the PSUV, the ruling political party, or the government's political party, won in the 2015 elections. They had been boycotting the National Assembly subsequent to a Supreme Court decision that the National Assembly was acting illegally, right, because it refused to comply with rerunning the election for three candidates who were alleged to have been elected with unacceptable irregularities at the time of the 2015 elections. Now, the opposition-controlled National Assembly refused to accept that Supreme Court judgment, which didn't affect their majority seriously at all. They just refused in principle to accept it. And what that meant was that they were in non-compliance with a judgment for the Supreme Court, and everything that they did was illegal. And as a legislature, nothing that they did from that point on was legal. So that meant that the 55 deputies loyal to the government withdrew from the National Assembly.
Right.
But under this new dialogue, one of the conditions that they've accepted is to reintegrate themselves into the National Assembly.
Right.
And in exchange, what they've got is a commitment from the moderate opposition deputies to call for an end to sanctions, and they've also got the deputies to accept support for Venezuela's diplomatic position as regards the Essequibo territorial dispute with Guyana.
Right.
And they've also agreed to accept, the government has agreed and the opposition have agreed to accept a so-called trade-off between oil for food and medicine brokered by the United Nations. There's a series of conditions, right, that both sides have agreed, and both have made very significant concessions within the context of that negotiation. Something that, right, the usurper regime of Juan Guaido was resolutely opposed to, because their demand was a unilateral demand that Maduro resign, and they wouldn't accept anything else.
Right.
So they were never serious about negotiating. And these other moderate opposition figures seem to be much more serious about a genuine negotiation. And they have made progress getting concessions from the government. For example, the reincorporation of those deputies into the National Assembly. But it remains to be seen how both sides are going to manage the technicality that until the National Assembly recognizes and accepts the Supreme Court judgment of 2016, right, the everything done in the National Assembly is going to be administratively and technically illegal.
Well, perhaps.
So what are they going to do?
Perhaps you can assemble if not a majority, at least a sufficiently sized minority, to do some parliamentary wrangling, towards that end, we reinstate it. First of all, they've been acting as if they're entitled to demand and obtain resignation or the removal of Maduro based on the 2015 election. Legally, there's no basis for that whatsoever, but also politically, they won that election, absolutely. They won it, and they won it in a surprisingly, large fashion. The size of the majority inside the assembly is exaggerated over the actual vote. That's the design of the Constitution, though, and so they obtained that fairly and squarely to a degree. I mean, it was recognized as such by the Election Commission, so they're entitled to that. But it was not such a sweeping majority in the vote that even politically it appeared that they had the right to demand that Maduro resign because he's so unpopular. He was not at all unpopular. As a matter of fact, the conditions that were imposed on Venezuela by the United States at the time of that vote, they had a surprisingly strong support that refused to cave in. You know, it was in the order of 45% still supported the government.
Right.
So, you know.
Yeah, the reason the opposition won is because 2 million Chavista voters abstained.
Right. And that and being, you know, after they starved the country for, you know, for years to try to, you know, basically create misery, you know, throughout the population and had the entire comprador class in the street, you know, disrupting the damn country, everything that happened in the country.
Yeah, and it's also worth remembering, Don, that that was a very special political moment in regional terms.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you had people who'd been used to almost 10 years across the region, in Venezuela, well over 10 years, something like 16, 17 years of progressive government in power, and people were seduced by the phony right-wing rhetoric. Well, we need a change, and if you vote for us, things will be better. And that was in the context of what was essentially a mild world recession, which had provoked a strong slowdown in economic activity for the region, especially in terms of their exports, which are extremely vulnerable to external factors over which they had no control.
The mild recession was mild elsewhere, but exactly with the drop in commodities prices, it was felt very, very strongly in a lot of these countries that rely on commodity sales as an engine of their economy.
Yeah, so I'm sticking with that issue of what's going to happen in the National Assembly in Venezuela. And 67 seats in Venezuela's legislature, and the opposition back in 2015 won 112. PSUV and allies hung on to something like 55. What I'm puzzled about is, do the moderate opposition politicians with which Nicolas Maduro and his government are negotiating have sufficient numbers of deputies to get? They need 29. The PSUV need 29 more deputies to be able to reach the figure of a majority of 84 in order to push through legislation that would validate the agreements.
Right.
The different points of the agreement that's just been reached.
Right.
So we'll see over the next 2, 3, 4 weeks. Does this agreement actually mean that there's going to be a sufficient majority to at least push through the joint government stroke moderate opposition position against the extremist positions of First, Justice First, and the Popular Will parties, the extremist parties.
Right.
So we'll see. But that has effectively broken the back of the U.S. attempt to monopolize the internal agenda in Venezuela.
Right.
So not only have they completely failed with their external pressure to destroy the Venezuelan economy, and just an interesting detail. And a couple of interesting details. The first one is that just recently Nicolas Maduro handed over the 2,400,000th house to a Venezuelan family as part of the Venezuelan government's program of providing free housing to low-income Venezuelan families. And remember, Venezuela's got a population of, 28 million, something like that.
Yeah.
So if the government has just handed over, or over the period of the last 10 or so years, they've handed over 2,400,000 houses to people in Venezuela. That's the figure that I saw. So which is just incredible given the current context and given the context of the last 3, 4, 5 years. The other point that's important to note is that every month. And the government makes sure that over 7 million families receive subsidized packets of food or packets of food at subsidized prices to enable them to overcome the threat of widespread hunger in the country, which is what the US economic sanctions are designed to achieve. And the US has failed in that objective because the Venezuelan government has tried to ensure that that huge number of families, families, get food every month. And so that's another objective of right. the invocation of the Reciprocal Assistance Treaty True. By the United States, because one of the things that's been discussed is a naval blockade to actually prevent food and medicine arriving in Venezuela, coupled with an air control zone,
right,
a no-fly zone over right. Venezuela. That's one of the objectives of the so-called TIA, this Reciprocal Assistance Treaty. So we have to see how all that pans out. But
you also have Guaido at the Colombian border, for example, and you're right, because the history of this treaty is that this particular section was used exactly for the so-called quarantine that was imposed on Cuba during the missile crisis in 1962. This is what they believe is legal cloaking for this kind of illegal activity, a quarantine boat, shipping embargo.
Right. And on that issue of the relationship between Guaido and Colombia, another interesting news item that came out of the last few days is that various photos have been published of Juan Guaido posing together with very, very notorious Colombian paramilitaries from the so-called Los Rastrojos paramilitary group, which controls the area of North Santander, the area north of Cúcuta, which was the town where Guaido and his U.S. owners tried to stage an attempt to invade or introduce so-called humanitarian aid, which in fact was an attempt to invade Venezuelan territory by Guaido. Right. And it was a place where Richard Branson organized a live music concert in support of Juan Guaido. And that itself is an indication of, who supports Juan Guaido. Well, of course, international corporate business does.
Exactly.
Because they right. So, but the it's much more significant, the fact that Guaido appeared posing with photos with those people, because, as has been pointed out by a Colombian academic, a Colombian sociologist who's been trying to pin down the relationship between the Colombian authorities and the paramilitaries in different parts of Colombia, but particularly in that area was where the reason Guaido is associated with that group is because that area along the border between Colombia and Venezuela is where Guaido infiltrated with the help of the Colombian paramilitaries.
Right.
Now, that's very significant, because what happened? Guaido got to a point close to the border, made his way across the border with the help of these Colombian paramilitaries, and they put him on the Colombian president's helicopter to take him to the concert organized by Richard Branson.
We're out of time. Let me just say one thing to fill this in, so people understand exactly what we're talking about in terms of significance. These same people that we're talking about have so far killed over 770 social and community leaders, murdered them since 2016, including 150 ex-FARC fighters who surrendered their weapons under a peace treaty and were then murdered by the same people that Juan Guaido is now hanging out with. So we got to stop there because we're out of time, but we can pick up next week and probe this whole thing a lot deeper, because I think it warrants it.
Yeah, sure. Definitely.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a million, Don.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. We'll speak with you again next week. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.